Lecture 4. Fictional Characters, Imagined and Observed.
No fictional character is created out of nothing. All writers draw, both consciously and unconsciously, on behaviors, traits, and actions we have seen in ourselves or in others. As a result, all the characters you create combine to form a portrait of your view of human nature. But although the roots of any character lie in your observations of yourself and of other people, those observations are refracted through your imagination. In the last lecture, I talked about the continuum between complete intimacy with the character and no intimacy at all. In this lecture, I want to start by talking about another continuum between observation on the one hand and imagination on the other. Some writers hew more closely to observation than to imagination. They base their characters almost entirely on people they know, writing thinly disguised versions of their family or friends, and sometimes sharply etched versions of people they want to get back at. Woe betide the family that has a writer in it. The British novelist Edward St. Aubyn has written a series of 5 novels about a character named Patrick Melrose, whose harrowing family history is based on St. Aubyn's. And it's not just limited to families. The American writer Ann Beattie once said that she had learned to throw very nice dinner parties for her friends by way of apology for the thinly disguised versions of themselves that appear in her stories. On the other hand, many writers write very convincingly about characters who are unlike the people they know or about experiences they've never had themselves. The Red Badge of Courage is perhaps the most vivid fictional account of combat during the American Civil War, but its author, Stephen Crane, wasn't even born until 6 years after the war ended, and he had not yet personally seen a battle when he wrote the book. Other writers venture even further afield, not only writing about experiences they haven't had themselves, but creating characters who are a different gender, age, background, ethnicity, or temperament from the author. The first 3 books by the British novelist Pat Barker stay close to her own experience of having grown up as a woman in the north of England. But later in her career, she went on to write 3 superb novels about World War I, Regeneration, The Eye in the Door, and The Ghost Road, in which she created a wide variety of vivid and believable male characters who have experienced at least 2 things Barker herself has never experienced, namely being in combat and simply being a man. And of course, there are all sorts of variations along the continuum between pure observation and pure imagination. Take the case of historical novels, such as Marguerite Yourcenar's The Memoirs of Hadrian, in which the novelist combines a real figure from history with both real and imaginary characters from the same period, in order to evoke the life and times of the title character, the Roman Emperor Hadrian. In Yourcenar's novel, we hear directly from the emperor himself in the form of fictional memoir. Yourcenar takes what is actually known about the real Hadrian and uses her imagination to inhabit the emperor's consciousness. She treats Hadrian the way she would treat a wholly imaginary character while also trying to stay faithful to the historical record. But whichever pole a writer tends towards, observation or imagination, no writer relies purely on one or the other. Yourcenar may base her character on a real emperor, and Edward St. Aubyn may base his characters closely on his family and friends, but both writers still have to exercise their imaginations in order to see the world through the eyes of these characters, and to show how the characters would behave in a fictional situation in which their real-life models may never have found themselves. Yourcenar, for example, doesn't write only about Hadrian's public life, but also about the sort of private, intimate scenes that are never recorded by history, imagining actions and thoughts that would only have been known to Hadrian himself. And while much of St. Aubyn's saga of family dysfunction is told from the point of view of Patrick Melrose, the character based on himself, much of it is told from the point of view of the other people in Melrose's life. This means that St. Aubyn needed to imagine his way into the minds of the people around him. Conversely, while Pat Barker's evocation of the inner lives of men is a brilliant act of the imagination, No doubt she did her homework as well, talking to veterans or reading memoirs and histories by men who actually had been in the trenches, and then filtering this information through her imagination. But whether you're drawing your characters from life in every detail, or you're making them up entirely out of whole cloth, you have to start somewhere. To help you think about that, I'm going to introduce yet another continuum. I'm very big on continuums. To go along with the one between imagination and observation. This new one is the difference between creating a character from the outside in versus creating a character from the inside out. As I said in the last lecture, one of the defining features of fiction is that an author can give us direct access to the thoughts of her characters, even if she sometimes chooses not to. And even for those characters whose thoughts we do have access to, there are many different ways to express them. If you think of the continuum between observation and imagination as one axis, consider that there's another axis at right angles to this one, and that the poles of that axis are the exterior approach and the interior approach. To help you understand what I mean by this, consider the difference between the British style of stage and film acting and the American style of acting, at least as these two styles were practiced during the 1950s and 60s. During this time, the method style of acting became popular among young American actors such as Marlon Brando and Shelley Winters. This method required the actor to identify with the character he or she was playing, to analyze that character's psychology in depth, and to use elements from the actor's own memories to evoke the emotion the character was feeling. In other words, to oversimplify, the actor was encouraged as much as possible to become the character. On the other hand, the British actor was trained to build a character out of little physical details and bits of behavior, an accent, a gesture, a prosthetic nose. The actor Charles Laughton told the director Alfred Hitchcock that he didn't really get the character he was playing in their film Jamaica Inn until he got the character's walk just right. And many great actors, such as Alec Guinness and Laurence Olivier, devoted a great deal of care to a character's appearance, taking special pride in wearing false teeth or elaborate hairpieces. In fact, Olivier is reputed to have given another actor a piece of advice: let the wig do the work. In this analogy, the American actor is using the interior method, building a character from the inside out, using the character's psychology to dictate his or her behavior. Meanwhile, the British actor is using the exterior method, building the character from the outside in, using external details to evoke the character's personality. Fiction writers often use similar approaches, working from the outside in or from the inside out. Let's take a look at how several writers have used these different methods in practice. In the opening pages of her great comic novel, Emma, Jane Austen lays the title character bare, simply by telling us point-blank almost everything we need to know about her. Austen does this very quickly and economically in the first paragraph of the novel. Emma Woodhouse, handsome, clever, and rich, with a comfortable home and a happy disposition, seemed to unite some of the best blessings of existence and had lived nearly 21 years in the world with very little to vex or distress her. Then, after two paragraphs that explain Emma's family situation, her mother is dead, her older sister has married and moved away, and her best friend is her governess, Miss Taylor, Austen tells us this: "The real evils indeed of Emma's situation were the power of having rather too much her own way, and a disposition to think a little too well of herself. These were the disadvantages which threatened to alloy her many enjoyments. The danger, however, was at present so unperceived that they did not by any means rank as misfortunes with her." Taken together, these two paragraphs are exactly 100 words, and the rest of the novel is essentially a gloss on those first two pages. For the rest of the book, we observe Emma's impetuosity, vanity, and cluelessness as she tries to manage the love lives of everyone around her without recognizing her own true love. Until the last pages, of course. This is a Jane Austen novel, after all. There's no need for any Mrs. Dalloway-style intimacy with Emma's stream of consciousness, though that might have been interesting. And at least to start with, there's no standing back and watching her slowly reveal herself through her speech and her behavior, the way we learn about Sam Spade. Now, Jane Austen simply tells us right from the start what's what with Emma, and then launches into her story. And then we get plenty of Emma's speech and behavior, but only after what we've already been told what she's like. Austen's description of Emma is frank, to the point, and unironic. Jane Austen never has Emma do anything later on in the book that undercuts her original description. And so with Emma firmly fixed in our imaginations as a vain, beautiful, meddlesome girl after reading only the first two pages, we are free to enjoy her effect on the people around her for the rest of the story. This approach works especially well with comic fiction, which often depends on types rather than fully developed characters, or at least on characters who never really change your first impression of them. Think of the Duke and the Dauphin, the two conniving swindlers in Huckleberry Finn, or nearly all the characters in Evelyn Waugh's first few novels, or pretty much everybody in Joseph Heller's great anti-war comedy, Catch-22. We learn everything we need to know about these characters the first time we meet them. Then, in each instance, the author just turns them loose to wreak havoc on each other or on themselves. Now compare this with a more indirect, interior approach, one that works from the inside out and one that feels more modern. Here are the opening paragraphs of Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre. There was no possibility of taking a walk that day. We had been wandering indeed in the leafless shrubbery an hour in the morning, but since dinner, Mrs. Reed, when there was no company, dined early, the cold winter wind had brought with it clouds so somber and a rain so penetrating that further outdoor exercise was now out of the question. I was glad of it. I never liked long walks, especially on chilly afternoons. Dreadful to me was the coming home in the raw twilight with nipped fingers and toes, and a heart saddened by the chidings of Bessie, the nurse, and humbled by the consciousness of my physical inferiority to Eliza, John, and Georgiana Reed. The said Eliza, John, and Georgiana were now clustered round their mama in the drawing room. She lay reclined on a sofa by the fireside, and with her darlings about her, for the time neither quarreling nor crying, looked perfectly happy. Me, she had dispensed from joining the group, saying she regretted to be under the necessity of keeping me at a distance, but that until she heard from Bessie and could discover by her own observation that I was endeavoring in good earnest to acquire a more sociable and childlike disposition, a more attractive and sprightly manner, something lighter, franker, more natural, as it were, she must really exclude me from privileges intended only for contented, happy little children. What does Bessie say I have done? I asked. This is only 246 words, and yet it feels longer, because it is packed with detail. In that brief space, we learn that we have an adult, first-person narrator who is looking back with bitter irony on her unhappy life as a child. We learn that she grew up with a family to whom she was not related by blood. And we learn that in that household there were three other quarrelsome children, their haughty mother, and a judgmental nurse. More importantly, we learn that Jane was considered to be an unwelcome outsider by this unpleasant family. And most importantly, we learn that even as a girl, Jane Eyre knew how to stick up for herself, that she is every bit as determined and headstrong as Emma Woodhouse. But the difference between Jane Eyre and Emma is that we don't learn everything about Jane in those first few paragraphs. Instead, we are drawn only gradually into the story while being given hints of her struggles to come. In that unwelcoming household on that dreary, cold day, the coming conflict of the book, namely, the irresistible force of Jane Eyre against the immovable object of the world, is only suggested. This technique works better than Jane Austen's would in this instance, because Jane Eyre is a darker, more serious book. There's more at stake here than the romances and marriages among the idle rich. In those first few paragraphs, we get a foreshadowing of Jane's struggle to survive in a world in which she has no money, no connections, and no prospects. In other words, how you decide to configure your characters, from the outside in or the inside out, has a profound effect on the sort of story you're going to end up writing. Whether the characters determine the story or the story determines the character is up to you, of course. But even so, the characters and story are so inextricably intertwined, you probably won't be able to tell which is the cause and which is the effect. A comedy, for example, often announces itself right from the start by being funny and staying funny. This depends on characters who can be quickly and easily identified. A drama, on the other hand, often draws you in with an intriguing situation, the distinctive voice of a strong character, and the suggestion of more trouble to come. Jane Eyre's world is more complex and unpredictable than Emma Woodhouse's, and this extra complexity requires a more subtle and complex main character. While Emma eventually grows up and learns not to meddle in the affairs of others, she doesn't do much to surprise us. Jane Eyre, on the other hand, having shown us that she's smart and judgmental from the first page, turns out to be surprisingly wrong in her judgments of some of the other characters, particularly about Mr. Rochester, the brooding master of the household where she ends up as a governess. Another way to look at the difference between these two approaches is to consider just how much you want the reader to identify with the character. By writing in the third person and by telling the reader directly of Emma's vanity and stubborn self-regard in the first few pages, Austen invites the reader to detach herself from Emma and to view her, as Austen does, from a remove, with a bemused and slightly condescending affection. Charlotte Bronte, on the other hand, has Jane Eyre herself address the reader directly in the first person. This forceful voice invites the reader to view the world through Jane's eyes and to endorse Jane's judgments of the other people in it. It would take a heartless reader, or at least a stubbornly contrarian one, to read those opening paragraphs of Jane Eyre and find himself taking the side of Mrs. Reed and her awful children against Jane. And since this is a continuum and not an either-or choice, I want to emphasize that there are all sorts of variations in between. Using the first person, for example, is not automatically a sign that the author is writing from the inside out or that he is inviting us to identify with the character. Let's hope there aren't many readers who identify with the pedophile Humbert Humbert, who narrates Nabokov's novel Lolita in the first person. And it's certainly not a hard and fast rule that comic narratives require the reader to be put at a distance. The British novelist Nick Hornby writes very funny and sneakily profound books, such as About a Boy, which is in the third person, and How to Be Good, which is in the first. And in both of these books, he invites us to regard his characters warmly, no matter how foolishly they're behaving, and to see ourselves in their foolishness. Indeed, you might even say that Hornby's books fall spang dab in the middle of the range, regarding their characters with great affection, but also without any illusions. To look at this continuum from a slightly different angle, think about the difference between a character who is defined by her psychology versus a character who is defined by her circumstances. This is close to being the same thing as the split between working from the outside in and working from the inside out, but it's not exactly the same. To use our earlier examples, we're tempted to think that Emma Woodhouse is determined by her circumstances and not by her psychology. But you can actually look at it the other way around. What makes the book funny is the way that Emma's particular psychology butts up against the people and the world around her. And in Jane Eyre, even though we have instant access to Jane's mind from the first sentence, it's the circumstances of her life that largely determine the course of the novel, though we see that struggle mainly through its effect on her thoughts and feelings. Another tempting generalization is that character-driven narratives, such as Mrs. Dalloway, rely more on psychology than plot-driven narratives, such as The Maltese Falcon. I'm not sure that's entirely true either. Even though we don't have access to Sam Spade's mind the way we have access to Mrs. Dalloway's, and even though The Maltese Falcon is packed with dramatic incident, including violence and the threat of violence, the narrative mainly works as a record of Sam Spade's decisions at every moment. These decisions are often a mystery to the reader because the motivation for some of the things he does are unclear until the end of the book. But the fact remains that Sam Spade's thoughts and feelings drive all his actions, even though his thoughts and feelings are never directly expressed to the reader. In its own oblique way, The Maltese Falcon is a very psychological book. Among the characters who are largely determined by their circumstances, you might include many of the characters in Dickens, as well as many of the characters of realist American writers such as Theodore Dreiser, Edith Wharton, and Sinclair Lewis. Even though we have direct access to the thoughts of many of the characters in the works of these authors, the fact remains that their thoughts do not determine their conduct as much as their circumstances do. Oliver Twist, for example, is defined by the fact that he's a homeless orphan, while the title character of Theodore Dreiser's novel, Sister Carrie, is defined by her journey from the rural Wisconsin to the opportunities and temptations of Chicago. What all these writers have in common is that their books tend, on the whole, to be large-scale portraits of a whole city or a whole class of people. The emphasis is on the social world of the characters and not so much on their individual choices. You find a similar effect in large-scale fantasy novels, the sort that create a richly detailed world for the reader to inhabit. In George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire series, the characters are vivid and complex, and sometimes etched with real psychological insight, but for the most part, they exist to illuminate the social world in which they move, not the other way around. Which is not to say they don't have a psychology. The evil young King Joffrey, for example, is clearly a heartless psychopath, but his pathology is not dwelt upon for its own sake, but rather serves as the reason for his extremely capricious and violent behavior within the complex and detailed world of Martin's fantasy. In other words, there's an intimate relationship between the sort of characters you create and the sort of narrative you write. In fact, they may be inseparable. You could just as easily say that the sort of characters you decide to use determines the kind of story you write, as you could say that the kind of story you decide to write determines the sort of characters you use. You can't really make up your mind about one without making up your mind about the other. And, as I keep stressing, these are continuums I'm talking about, not either-or decisions. John Updike, in his novels about the middle-class everyman Harry Rabbit Angstrom, was writing, on one level, the same kind of social realist novel that Sinclair Lewis and Theodore Dreiser were, with very careful attention to getting the social milieu just right. But at the same time, he was writing an acutely psychological portrait of Rabbit Angstrom, lavishing as much attention on Rabbit's thoughts and feelings as Virginia Woolf ever did with Mrs. Dalloway. And of course, the same writer at different times will try different sorts of stories with different sorts of characters. My own first novel, The Wild Colonial Boy, was a political thriller set in Northern Ireland during the 1980s. It tells the story of a callow young Irish American who helps some members of the Irish Republican Army carry out a terrorist bombing in London. The book is told in the third person, but each section is narrated from the point of view of one of four different characters. While I was certainly concerned to get the psychology of each character right, it was a plot-driven novel in which the characters mainly react to circumstances. The book is also a kind of tragedy in which the lives of each of these four characters is shattered and in one case ended. And tragedy often requires a kind of inevitability. There's an implicit view of the world in a narrative like this, one that assumes that people don't really understand their own motives and desires, and though they think they're making rational decisions, they're being driven by circumstances and their own weakness. This was certainly true of my main character, Brian, who ends up helping to perpetrate an atrocity, a bombing in an art museum, out of a dilettantish idealism, a misplaced desire for adventure, and an inability to say no to someone else with a stronger personality. And yet, though their psychology may not have been important as their circumstances, Brian and the other three major characters are mainly pure products of my imagination, and they were created from the inside out, as I evoked each chapter or individual scene from each character's point of view. Plot rattled right along, if I do say so myself, and you never saw it from a distance, but from above, at any given moment, only through the eyes of one of its participants. 10 years later, I published a very different novel called The Lecturer's Tale, a satire of academia. It was a much longer book with a much wilder plot and a lot more characters. My intent was to make fun of certain tendencies and ideologies in academic literary criticism, with the result that the characters were much less complex than the characters in The Wild Colonial Boy. They were drawn more from life than from my imagination. Some were based on, or composites of, real academics I'd read about, with their particular personalities and characteristics heightened for satiric effect. These characters are created from the outside in. Like Laurence Olivier putting on a hump and a prosthetic nose to play Richard III, I created them out of their appearances, their funny ways of speaking, and their often outrageous beliefs and actions. The novel's point of view character, a hapless, mediocre young professor named Nelson, was a bit more complex than the other people in the book, but not by much. A lot of the characters were like Dickens characters, in fact, with one or two instantly vivid, recognizable characteristics and no real psychology to speak of. The book was meant to be a comedy of ideas, and the characters were just complex enough to get my point across. Then, in my most recent novel, Next, I attempted to do something different yet again. I wanted to try my hand at one of those novels like Mrs. Dalloway that looks at one character's life over the course of a single day. I'm not even remotely in the same league as Virginia Woolf, of course, but I thought it might be fun to write a book that was more or less plotless and see if I could create a character by following the lightning shifts of his consciousness moment by moment over the course of a few hours. This way, I could reveal much of his history and personality to the reader, much like Mrs. Dalloway, in fact, only with more jokes and not nearly as good. To align him along the continuums I've been using in this lecture, my main character, Kevin, was created completely from the inside out. There's not a single moment in the book that doesn't come from his point of view. And my evocation of him is, obviously, intensely psychological, shifting from paragraph to paragraph and even from sentence to sentence, from what's right in front of him at a given moment to his remotest memories, from the comic to the serious, from the trivial to the profound. For some writers, choosing whether to work from the outside in or the inside out is purely instinctive. You just sit down at the keyboard and you start to write in the first person or the third person, as the case may be. Even so, sometimes it turns out that what comes naturally doesn't work, and you may have to go back and do it a different way. You can also be more self-conscious and deliberate about it by thinking long and hard about what's more important to your story. Do you want the characters to be reflective of the larger world they inhabit? Or do you want to write a more intimate story from inside one consciousness? How you answer that question will tell you how to create your character. With Next, for example, I had to be quite self-conscious about how I created Kevin, because on the one hand, I wanted the reader to be in his head the whole time, but on the other hand, for certain structural reasons, I couldn't let him speak for himself in the first person. So I created a character from the inside out, but written in the third person. There's no one way to do it, so you may have to find your own way by trial and error. Let's sum up where we are. In the last lecture, I talked about how characters are different from real people, namely that they're simpler, they're made up of the most dramatic and/or representative moments, and that we can hear what they're thinking sometimes. In this lecture, I talked about three different approaches to creating character, by using observation and imagination, by working from the inside out or the outside in, or by determining a character from his or her psychology or his or her circumstances. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk about the things that all characters have in common. Well, the things that most of them do anyway. And I'm going to talk about how all characters are created out of evocative detail. And in the lecture after that, I'm going to talk about the different types of character and how you can use them in the same narrative. In the next lecture, we're going to talk about introducing characters with examples from Joseph Conrad's Lord Jim, Eva Figgis's Light, Kate Christensen's The Epicure's Lament, and William Faulkner's A Rose for Emily. And in the lecture after that, I'm going to talk about major and minor characters and also about E.M. Forster's famous distinction between round and flat characters with examples from such writers as Mark Twain, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Leo Tolstoy, and Denise Mina. In the meantime, here's an exercise from an excellent book called What If? Writing Exercises for Fiction Writers by Anne Bernays and Pamela Painter. Pick a character from a story or a novel that has already been written, either by you or someone else, and make a list of everything you know or can infer about the character. Include basic features such as the character's name, age, gender, appearance, relationship status, and so on. But also include such things as the character's fears, obsessions, and politics, even if they aren't mentioned explicitly in the text. You'll find, I think, that depending on the sort of narrative it is, you may not be able to get a complete list for any character. Such a list for Elizabeth Bennet from Pride and Prejudice, for example, would include a great deal about her opinions and personality, but nothing about her appearance. On the other hand, you could detail Sam Spade's physical appearance, but you can't find much about his opinions on anything. You're going to find in this exercise that different types of stories require different types of characters.